Today is May 23rd, 2009. This is Conduit Main Address with Dave Wolverton.
Is it in this room?
Yes, it is, Charlie.
Oh. We had a little drawing that we held. This was announced on some of the email lists. If you hadn't heard, it was actually for pre-registered attendees. All pre-registered attendees were put into a hat. We pulled the name out, and the prize are these handcrafted magic wands. These were donated by Mike Oberg. He knows he's been a good friend of Conduit for quite a while. He's been chair of Conduit for multiple times. Dennis Voigt is the winner. Is Dennis here? You'll also notice I've got another wand, too. We're doing a second drawing. You might have seen them. There's some questionnaire forms outside of registration. They're sprinkled around a few other places as well. It's a short questionnaire. Just let us know what you like, what you didn't like. If you want to leave some comments, you can write those on back. Please fill those out. We'll put everybody's that does so into the drawing. But it's also really good information for us. We need to know what you guys think about the convention. The other way you can do that, of course, is find folks like me with the lavender badges. We're all on the committee, and we'd love to hear what you think. Without further ado, I think I should probably give a little bit better intro than just giving his name. But let's go to the sorcerer. You guys probably had a chance to hear from Dave, so I'll let him tell you a little bit.
Okay. Well, I am Dave Wolverton / David Farland / David Tong. That's going to be what my next controller book will be coming out under when I get that finished and turned in. First of all, I have a very soft voice, so if I ever start, getting so you can't hear me, just speak up, and I'll try to speak up for you.
In that voice.
I'd like to say, kind of sorry that Eric Cliff isn't here. Eric is an old friend of mine. In fact, I published his first short story in Writers of the Future. It was 15, 20 years ago, something like that. It was called, let's see if I can remember the title. Let's see, Entropy and the Strangler. A comic piece about a strangler who philosophizes a great deal, often while he's killing people. And I remember reading that story, and I've been wanting in Writers of the Future for some time to find somebody who was a good fantasy writer, but also just a really good writer, and I really liked Eric's work right from the beginning. And so as a result of that, after he won Writers of the Future, we became friends, and we used to talk on the phone probably every 2 or 3 weeks. We'd sit down, and Eric had a bad back. And was working as a machinist, and his back seemed to be getting worse all the time. It was, really kind of crippling him up. So when his agent quit working with Russell Galen Agency, Shauna McCarthy, I'd heard about it from Russell Galen, so I called Eric immediately and said, hey, Shauna McCarthy, who was the former editor at Asimov's, is, starting up her own little agency. You really ought to get with her. So he sent off a sample of work to her, and they've still been together over all these years. And then, a little bit later on, probably just a few weeks after that, Eric mentioned that he was going to be sending something off to Jim Bain and Bain Books. And I happened to be at a convention and had breakfast with Jim Bain. And I said, oh, hey, this Eric Flint guy is going to be sending you a book, and you really ought to publish this guy. And he's like, Eric Flint, why should I publish Eric Flint, Then we just sat down and talked about Eric Flint for a while. They ended up becoming very good friends, of course, as you know, and now Eric works there as the editor for the Jim Bain's magazine and also for some of the book lines and stuff. So I was really sorry that Eric got sick, but I'm also glad that his surgery went well, and I guess that he's recovering nicely, and maybe he'll be able to make it some other time. As an author, when you come to one of these things, there are a couple of things that you want to do. First of all, you want to be entertaining, and you also want to be inspiring and educational. And it's sort of this war that goes on between you as to which one you want to do the most. And eventually, I just decided to heck with all of it. I'm not going to be any of those. I don't really know what I'm going to, where my mix comes in on this. But what I do know is that as a writer, who's been working now at it for 30 years. I think when I started out, that I used to have this idea that if you wrote a book, it was just sort of a matter of stringing words together correctly, and you know, voila, you have this bestseller. Okay, and so I kind of suffered from that delusion that all you know youngsters have, that you know everything. Okay, mm-hmm. Now as you get older though, and you start realizing how complex the world really is, you start suffering from the other delusion, which is that you know nothing. And I'm fully involved in that phase of my career right now, where I kind of look at things and I'm really feeling kind of mystified. And I feel mystified about the whole area of communication. You know, when you try to communicate with another person, you sort of, you know, you throw out your words, you put everything on paper, you think that you've got it all just perfectly, and then you get some reviewer who totally misunderstands you, who just seems to be coming out of left field completely. And you're saying, where is that communication? Where is that breakdown? Or why does communication work at all? I was reading an Isaac Asimov story yesterday that he had written in about 1950. And as I was reading it, I was thinking about quite a couple of different things. First of all, I'd always loved Isaac Asimov, read him up till the day he died. And he was one of my heroes and one of my mentors when I was young, to some degree. But as I was reading this story from the 1950s, I was surprised at how little description Isaac had in his story at all. So little description that for most of the time I couldn't envision what was going on at all. Not that that made a great deal of difference, because like many of the stories, it was in his head. It was a very internal story about people's thought processes. But I also got to the point where I thought, you know, what's really amazing to me is that anybody could understand this at all, because there was so little that was really there. And I started thinking about how, as readers, you know, we very often we sort of have to kind of cross this bridge and try and struggle to understand what is going on. And, you know, as a writer, I'm like, no, I don't want that to happen. I want my readers to always be able to understand and to vision, perfectly everything that I'm trying to say. You know, I just want it to be effortless on their part. And as a writer, I got to think, yeah, I'm going to have to redouble my efforts to be a great communicator, as if I don't try hard enough. So anyway, those are kind of some of the things that go on in life. And, you know, a lot of times we miscommunicate. You know, no matter what you do, it seems like you can't help but miscommunicate. 2 weeks ago, my wife and I were talking, and she says, well, what did you do today? And I said, oh, you know, I spent all morning filling out this questionnaire for an article for this travel magazine that they wanted to do on me. And then I had to go find the pictures. And I was looking for those pictures from China, and I was looking for those pictures that I took when we were in Florida last year, because they wanted to know about my, you know, where I go traveling and stuff. And she says, oh, okay, and, you know, la da da da. And she asked me about that like 2 or 3 times. What did you do today? Oh, I finished, sending this article off for the travel guys, and I had to get some more pictures and anything. So the day before yesterday, I show her this article, you know. And I said, look, we got our article published. We're in a travel magazine in South Africa. And she's like, how did they do that? Where did they get those pictures? You know, you showed them that picture of me? You know, like, look, you know, nobody's going to care what we look like in South Africa. You know, but the thing is that, you know, that I didn't know is that I'm really popular in South Africa. Okay, I keep getting, you know, emails from bookstores saying, we'd like to do a virtual book signing with you where you know, you sign nameplates and we'll, you know, have you on the telephone maybe or something and be a guest and you can talk to people while they're getting their books, plates put in their books and things like that. So, you know, as an author, you never know exactly where you're going to be popular. And when you start thinking about that, it's just amazing to me that here on the very farthest side of the world, you know, I have this body of fans that think I'm cool enough that I should be featured in a travel magazine like I was Madonna or something, you know. And that happens all the time, you know. We don't really communicate real well with people from other countries and stuff. I mean, sometimes there are dramatic differences. I was traveling in England a couple of years ago, about 10 years ago now, and noticed just how difficult it was traveling in that particular country. I stopped on the west side of London, not knowing that, you know, most people can't understand anybody who's from the west side of London anyway. And I jumped into a cab, and the fellow says to me, "Vroom!" And I said, "I'd like to go to Piccadilly Circus, please." "Vroom!" "I'd like to go to Piccadilly Circus, please." And he looked at me with these pleading eyes like, "I can't understand a word you're saying." And I was like, "I can't understand the word you're saying." So I tried a couple more times, and finally we both just shrugged, and I got out of the cab. Supposedly he was speaking English, but I couldn't get it. I then went to the movie theater, and while I was at the movie theater, I was sitting there, went to watch Phantom of the Opera in the Royal Theater there in London, which is all, you know, decked out with gold trim and stuff, just really a great place to go see Phantom of the Opera. And while I'm sitting there, this guy comes walking through yelling, "Run, run!" And I'm like, "What's that guy yelling about? It sounds like he's got, like, what's that disease that people start swearing, you know?"
Correct.
You know, and he's come through and he's going, "No, no, no!" And I'm like, "What the devil's he saying?" So finally, there's this lady sitting next to me. She happens to be Oriental. And I said, "What in the world is that guy saying?" And she says, "Oh, he's saying, 'No, take pictures, please.'" And I'm like, "How did you get that?" You know, I theoretically speak English. That man was—I mean, if it had been a dog talking to me, I wouldn't have understood him less. Okay, so we have those kinds of habits. On that same trip in England, I was by Liverpool, and I stopped at a bed and breakfast. And stopping at this bed and breakfast, the woman took down my name and she says, "Wolverton, Wolverton." She says, "You know, didn't there used to be some Wolvertons that lived Birmingham. Weren't there some Wolvertons down from like by Birmingham once?" And I said, "Yeah, that's where my ancestors came from." And she says, "Well, they all ran off to be eaten by wild Indians." To me, that was an amazing remark. For one thing, my ancestors left Birmingham in 1681. Okay? Wow. Now, I have been trained that you're not supposed to gossip about people. But here they've been gossiping about us for 340 years. Okay? And it just sort of underscored the difference that this is an entire alien race over there, you know? Like, if somebody were to start gossiping about our neighbors, you know, and they started saying, you know, "I just can't get over what they did, you know? They ran off to New Zealand," and, you know, and I'd say to my wife, you know, "It's been 180 years. Get over it. You know, like, it's history." You know, but in England they don't do that. They just keep talking about you. So we have these communications differences and the differences in the way that people are, and I just kind of find all of that really fascinating. So as I was considering all of this, I want to make sure I don't miss a point. As you consider all of this, you start thinking about, hey, as a writer, what does all that mean to me? Okay, I'm going to have to write harder in order to bridge that gap between of understanding between me and my audience. To try to be more plain without being wordy. To try to make it so that my character or my readers can just kind of grab whatever's out there out of the ether and somehow make sense of what I'm trying to say. And hopefully come to the right conclusions each time. And that doesn't always happen. You know, if you have ever written a novel, you know that no matter how well you write it, you know, there's going to be people who are dissatisfied with it. If you look at something like Lord of the Rings, which is considered to be the best fantasy novel of all time, you know, the fans on Amazon.com give it like a 3.5, you know. And I'm sitting here going, wow, if that's a 3.5, how are you ever going to get any higher than 3.5 on your scores? The truth is that the better a reputation something has, the more people that have come along who decide they're going to try to tear down that reputation. And so there's some unhappy campers. But overall, you know, when you look at it, you go, it's also, you know, different tastes. You know, you write a book, and let's say you write a romance book, and you've got people who love it all over the world, and then somebody comes along and says, well, that's a hell of a book. I can't stand romances, you know. What a crappy book. And they start yelling at the top of their throat. It's sort of like, you know, making this great chocolate shake and then feeding it to somebody, you know, after you've discovered that the chocolate, you know, the best chocolate comes from Brazil, and, you know, it's heated to such and such a degree, and, you know, you have to flake it off, and, you know, we use unsweetened coconut to, you know, create the stuff, and you put it all in there, and they take a drink, and they go, yeah, I hate chocolate. You know, and no matter what you do, you can't quite get it right. And that's the problem that you have as a novelist, is trying to bridge that gap between what you're creating and what it is they want. And as I get older, I realize that things aren't exactly the way that I used to think they were. You know, writing that bestseller just isn't that easy. For one thing, when you're young, you're taught a lot of rules about writing. You know, oh, you've got to make sure that you don't have too many adverbs, you know, in your story. And you can't stack any nouns. And you've got to make sure you don't have word repetitions anywhere. You know, each word has to be brand new on the page. And, you know, and they get all these little rules that come up that make sense, sort of. And then you read something by somebody who's an international bestseller, and it's total crap, because they don't follow any of the rules that you've been struggling so hard to learn and to master. Instead, they're just telling this wonderful, vibrant story that sweeps people away. And, you know, the truth is that language doesn't matter very much. In fact, if you look at bestsellers that sell more than a million copies of a book, language doesn't matter at all. Instead, storytelling ability that matters. And when it comes to storytelling ability, what people are really looking for is powerful emotions that are being created through the storytelling medium. And so as I look at it from the point of view of an older author who's looking back and saying, what could I do differently if I wanted to do this over? I would be looking at it and saying, how can I create powerful emotions that are appropriate to my audience, okay? And by that I mean, if you are writing to a audience of 10-year-olds and you're writing about romantic love, it's probably not appropriate to that audience. First of all, their hormones haven't kicked in. Many of them are incapable of even understanding what you're talking about. I mean, you know, yeah, when I was a 10-year-old, I did sort of dream about kissing girls, but it was very, you know, like, gosh, what would that be like kind of thing, rather than this lusty, and then I'm going to mate with them and, you know, and make them my wife or my sex slaves or whatever. You know, that's just not appropriate. So you have to say what's appropriate to that audience. And, you know, there are certain ages in life where we go through different stages. When you're really young, you live in a world where the world is full of wonders and terrors, okay, and humor. And so, as a child, those are the main emotional appeal that you're looking for when you start looking for books to read. And so, if I'm writing to an 8 or 9 year old, I'm going to try to create a sense of wonder, a sense of terror, and I'm going to try to use humor and bring them along that way. As I write to an older audience where their hormones are kicking in, then I may be writing about romance. And hey, what does it take to make a woman fall in love with you? You know, that's a great question for a teenage boy to sit down and ponder. And then as you're writing for older people, You may be writing about growth and drama, you know, accepting your responsibilities as an adult, trying to deal with emotional relationships and that kind of thing. And then if you're dealing with the older audience, you know, 50s, 60-year-olds, you might want to start dealing with topics like death a little bit more seriously, okay? As you start dealing with these things that are appropriate, age-appropriate, and sex-appropriate, all of a sudden you start finding yourself on the bestseller list a lot more than if you worry about the little picky-uni things, you know, that you do when you're trying to write. The other thing that I look at as I'm getting older, I'm looking at writing, I'm looking really down on the micro level of stories, too, a lot more, you know. It's funny because it's, in one sense, I'm sitting here saying, wow, I've got to be keeping my head up here in the clouds. And then on another part of saying, you know, I also need to be working on the microscopic level a lot better than what I'm doing. And that almost seems like it's contradictory. But I think what really happens is that, you know, as an author, you get used to working somewhere in the middle. And as you start understanding the rules of the middle, then you start wondering about the mysteries of the macrocosm and the microcosm, okay? And so you start thinking about things like that a lot more. So I've been doing a lot of that kind of thing. Ultimately, though, lately I've been really impressed by how nothing that we really write seems to be new anymore, okay? And by that I mean even the things that other people see as startlingly original. As an old storyteller, I'm like, yep, seen that before, okay? But I'm going to give you an example here in a minute. But I like Patrick Rothfuss. In The Name of the Wind, which is a very nice fantasy novel, first fantasy novel, he has a character who's telling his story. And he says at one point, you know, part of what he does for a living is a storyteller, the character in the book. So he says, you know, I started, came into a small town, I was going to tell them a story, you know, and ask them what they wanted to hear. And several people mentioned, you know, oh, I want to hear this story or that story. And somebody mentioned, you know, this old classic. And he says, you know, I decided that old stories were the best and that that's what I should be doing. And I think that that was a metaphor for what he was doing with his novel. Was he was saying, I know I'm telling an old story. I'm telling an old story with new characters in a new way. And I'm basically updating it so that it's something exciting for today. And we as authors tend to do that an awful lot. Is if you look at a lot of stories, you know, there's not much originality to most of them. And it's to the point where there are some people, some critics, who say that we are incapable of understanding too many kinds of stories. That we don't, they don't appeal to us in part because even if I told you a story, let's say that I wrote a story that only people with IQs of 200 could understand, okay? I would be appealing to less than 0.02% of the population, okay? So I need to keep it at an intellectual level that people can understand. If I tried to deal with complex emotions that people can't understand, then I'd be, you know, doing things that just don't appeal to most people. But the reality is that we only seem to be capable of understanding certain types of things. We share common DNA, which makes us able to communicate. So that when I speak a certain number of nouns and verbs in a certain order, that you as another human, you know, are able to pick those up. And if you look at certain critics, for example, Joseph Campbell, he points out that in reality, he believes that it's because we have certain shared memories or shared beliefs that are sort of possibly bundled into us by genetic memories. Okay? Now, he talks about that as a possibility. And we know that there are such things as genetic memories. Okay? If you take a little baby that is one day old and you stick your finger out by his hand, what does the baby do? You know, he clasps your finger as hard as he possibly can and tries to hang on. Okay, that's because little baby monkeys know that if they don't hang on, they're going to fall out of a tree. And, you know, evolutionary, we have the same basic genetic makeup that they do. We also can see those types of behaviors in other animals. If you've got a baby chicken, okay, that just comes out of the egg, that baby chicken will cringe and freeze if you put a shadow over its head. Okay, that's a genetic memory that says, okay, watch out for hawks. If you have a baby calf, or any baby animal that's capable of movement at all, a baby calf or a baby horse, you know, the first thing that it'll do after it gets out of the womb is that it will go up and immediately start nursing off of its mother. It has a genetic memory that says this is how you eat. Okay. There's a lot of skepticism in the world about whether or not there are other possible genetic memories, and I've become convinced over the years that there are. In my particular family, my father taught us that we had a genetic memory that ran in our family, which the Wolverton men have been using for generations to know whether or not their wives were cheating on them. And here's the genetic memory. My dad got me and my brothers together. I had my six-year-old brother, and I was 11, and my older brother was 16. And he says, I want you boys to stand, you know, back to back. So we all stand in this circle where we're a little triangle where we're back to back. And he says, now imagine a sword. He says, imagine a sword, and it can be any color you want. It could be any shape you want. He says, I just want you to imagine yourself holding a sword. And so as he did this, you know, at first I thought, well, let me hold your sword up like this. And then I thought, no, that's not how you hold your sword. And then I realized the way you're supposed to hold your sword is you clasp your hands underneath the handle, you put your two fingers like this, and you, instead of holding your sword, instead of hold your sword out, you hold it down like this so that the tip is barely touching the ground. Okay? And that's the way you're supposed to hold your sword. So I'm sitting there going like that for about 30 seconds, and finally I go like that. My dad says, okay, now turn around. And we turn around. And my two brothers have their swords held out exactly the same way. And he says, I learned this from your great-great-grandfather, Thomas Jefferson Wolverton. He said, Wolverton boys know how to hold their swords, and if your son doesn't know how to hold a sword, your wife is cheating on you. Okay? So I thought, well, that's cool and unbelievable. Okay? However, when my daughter Nicole was born, you know, she was about 9 months old one day, and she climbs up and she gets up to the butter dish and she picks up the butter knife and she picks it up like this and looks at it like that, and then this kind of glazed look comes over her eyes.
Oh.
Like this, and she holds it like that and closes her eyes, and I go, aha, she's my daughter. She took probably all of 90 seconds to figure out how to hold her sword. My youngest son, Ben, was probably 4.5 months old when he climbed up on the table and we had him in his high chair. He climbs up and grabs the butter knife. He takes one look at it like that, immediately, boom, you know, and assumes a position. Okay. Now, this is a genetic memory that runs in our family that I am sure had to do with somebody who was a guard, because I could feel the pain in my arms that comes from holding the sword like that for hour after hour. Okay, so there's some little piece of DNA, and if you understand how memories become hardwired in your brain, you'll understand how this is possible, that says this is the way you hold your sword. Okay, now there are other memories, I am sure, that run throughout the human race. For example, on my wedding night, my wife and I drove down to Zion's, and there was this huge storm going on, and there's a mountain called something Throne down in Zion's.
Great White.
The Great White Throne? Yeah, the Great White Throne. Okay, the Great White Throne is up there, and it's this big white mountain. And and there's a storm going on, and there were clouds just sort of wreathing the top of the mountain, and lightning began striking, and it was just boom, kabloom, 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 all around the top of this mountain. And I just got this unholy sense of fear and terror and wonder. You know, it was like, you know, oh my gosh, there it is. And it was like witnessing God or something like that being there. And I realized, okay, there's some sort of a genetic memory that just triggered this and said, this is right. This is something that I knew was supposed to happen or was supposed to be there. Now, interestingly enough, when I saw that and started thinking about it, I thought, you know what this kind of reminds me of is the movie Fantasia, where we have what's it called? Might on Bald Mountain. Okay, where you have this big winged devil creature up there with the lightning crashing around him. I thought, could that possibly be coming from that? Well, you know, I thought about it and I said, you know, that never affected me as a child. It didn't affect me that to that degree. I mean, I thought that was a cool scene, but I didn't feel this sense of wonder and awe and, you know, all this kind of stuff that was going on. But I did remember what Tolkien had felt when he saw that particular scene. Tolkien, when he was writing Lord of the Rings, had begun it several years earlier, and he got to the part where they got into the Mines of Moriah, and he could not figure out what was going to happen next in his novel. And so he was stuck for roughly 2.5, almost 3 years, without having written a word. And he went and saw Fantasia, and after seeing that, he decided, he just said, it all came out of him at once, and he went and wrote the rest of the Mines of Moriah scene, which end up with the Balrog creature, which is the same devil creature from Night on Bald Mountain, fighting with him. I think that Tolkien, you know, and I must have been, like, had the same shaman in our background somewhere, you know, down the line, and that he had the same kind of visceral reaction to that that I do. Another genetic memory, I'm sure, is and with me comes when I see the image of the Green Man. How many of you know what the Green Man is? Okay. The Green Man, there's actually a little flag that's in the dealer's room, I noticed, has a picture of a man with leaves for hair and on his face. And I just remember, you know, when I was like maybe 14 years old, seeing that and going, and just staring at that, going, where have I seen that before? That feels so right. Who is that? And I've done some studying of the Green Man, trying to figure out, I think it was actually one of the Norse gods, the brothers of Freya, that may have been represented there. But, you know, they call him John Barleycorn in England, and he goes by a couple of other different names, and it's seen as far away as China, so the image seems to be around the world and just to be almost universal. And it was a sign of a representation of spring coming and new life and all of this kind of thing. And so so it's kind of a cool image, you know. But I've often felt sort of this visceral reaction to certain things and said, okay, what's going on here? Why do I have this strange genetic memory, you know, piece hanging on? And I think that that lies at the heart of a lot of stories, okay? A lot of our stories feel right because we've heard them before, because our ancestors heard them before. I'll give you an example. Went and saw the movie Star Trek, okay, a couple of weeks ago. Everybody's been talking about Star Trek. You know, is it good, is it bad? What struck me about Star Trek is, first of all, I loved it. I thought that it was the best Star Trek movie that's been made, easily, in my opinion. But it also struck me how it is also the oldest story that has ever been told. Okay, if you start looking at it as an archetypal piece of literature, you know, you'll notice first off, for example, that in ancient heroic literature, we often start off with the birth of the hero. Okay, and the birth of the hero and the death of the father figure are often tied together. Okay. So, young Captain James Kirk, when he is born, He is born from a line of heroes. Okay, that's one of the big things that happens. And of course, he has to avenge himself against the very same overwhelming villain that killed his father. We've seen that same kind of thing from, you know, Star Trek or Star Wars. You know, when they started out, that was going to be the story. That was pretty obvious. Luke finds out that you know, his father was a pilot who was killed by an evil Jedi Knight, and you know, and now he's out to face the exact same person who killed his father. In book two, we discovered that, or in the second movie, I should say, we discovered that that his father was in fact the villain. But in any case, it was clear from the way that the author had to, or the way that Lucas had to try to sidetrack and explain things, that that wasn't the original intent. You know, the original intent was to go, okay, we're dealing with the guy who killed your father. In any case, that's like the oldest story that's ever been told. And when you look at Star Trek, it also starts purposely trying to feed into your memories of other stories that you've read and enjoyed. Okay, for example, the very first scene has them coming out of a storm. Okay, classic, you know, storm in the opening, and they come out of this storm in space, and they come up to this giant alien ship. And their ship is much larger than the little, what's the name of it?
Kelvin.
The Kelvin, yes, it's the Kelvin. Okay, so they got this great big thing, it's like this. Now you'll notice a couple of things about this new ship. First of all, it's squid-like, okay? If you have studied what Lucas did with Star Wars, you know, Star Wars said, I wanted to make all of my ships look like animals, okay? So the Imperial Cruisers look like the heads of a snake, okay? If you get into the Millennium Falcon, let's see, what's the Millennium Falcon supposed to be? Like, remember? What? I can't recall. But anyway, so you notice, okay, wow, they've gone to using biological models for their new ships here. So you have the big squid, you know, coming out of space to attack their little ship. And then later on, when we get to Spock's ship, he has an interesting little ship that has this weird tail that wiggles like this. Actually, that was a diatom that I was reading about in Science News about 2 years ago. And they were talking about what a strange propulsion method this creature had, and it had a tail that just went around like a corkscrew. And it looks almost exactly like Spock's ship when you look at the overall shape. So they were using these biological models. But also, they were also harkening back to Star Trek, because when you see the opening, or Star Wars, when you see the opening of Star Wars, of course, you have the little ship being chased by the big giant ship, you know, and it's kind of cool. You see this big giant ship actually is getting, you know, shot at and everything, and as it goes on, you're, wow, it's a big ship, and then all of a sudden, you know, this really big ship comes into view, and you're going, oh, wow, that's such a little ship, you know, being chased by that really big ship. And you start seeing that, okay? Or the very fact that you have a character who's coming, you know, from the future, 150 years, I mean, it's Terminator, classic Terminator kind of thing. He's got this unstoppable technology. The very fact that you have Captain Kirk, in order to save his ship, has to steal, basically, fire from the gods, okay? In other words, he has to go to his enemy and steal the red matter, which they're using to blow up this other planet. You know, it all keeps harkening back to your ancient literature, to your archetypal literature. And even little things, like when you see, you know, the Captain Kirk for the first time as a young man, you see that he's a flawed young man. You know, he's impatient. He's, what's the word I want to use? Reckless. Yes, he's reckless. He's dangerous. He's pretty much out of control as a person. And yet, you know, he also is admirable in some ways, in that he's cunning. He's able to evade the police as he's flying off. You know, he's strong, you know, when he's thrown out of his out of his car and is, you know, hanging onto the edge of the cliff trying to claw his way back up, you know, you're going, yep, that's a pretty tough little kid, you know, to be able to handle all that. So there's some kind of cool stuff that he does. Once again, when we get into the Spock scenes, you know, we see, okay, here's a young man who lives trying to live by the ideal of being an emotionless, logical kind of person, and he's been taunted by others, you know, 34 times in the past, and all of a sudden, you know, we get to see that he's just not perfect. You know, if somebody pushes him far enough, he's gonna jump up on you and, you know, beat the stuffing out of you. So we have these cool little things going on with the characters, and we have the little growth arcs where we see them becoming heroes and stuff like that. And I think that all gets back to the fact that, you know, the old stories are the best stories. There's something in us genetically that yearns for stories to be a certain way, to teach a certain kind of thing, that we have this universally accepted body of knowledge. And that knowledge basically comes as we're told the hero tale. If you read the Popol Vuh, Mayan literature, it is not very different at all from ancient Babylonian literature, where we learn about their heroes, or the ancient Greeks, or the Romans. It is all the same story told over and over again about how to be a heroic character, how to be courageous, how to be brave, how to have the types of, be compassionate, how to be, to develop the type of character that each one of us needs in order to make society and the world succeed and the world to expand and grow. And so, you know, as an author, I guess, for a long time, I've thought, oh, God, I want to be original. I want to do something different, you know. And just in the last few weeks, I've started to realize, you know what? I want to be completely unoriginal. I want to go back and write the old stories. And because the old stories really are the best. And by that, I mean, you know, don't be completely unoriginal. You update them. You set them for people of our times and with, you know, new heroes that maybe have qualities that are a little bit different from the qualities that we've seen expressed in the past, but create heroes that are the kinds of people that you see as being necessary for the future. So, anyway, that's kind of what I've decided to do in my spare time. Beyond that, any questions? Okay. Well, how much time do we have anyway?
Who do you consider some of your influences?
Who do I consider my influences? You know, there are a lot of different people. I've always loved Orson Scott Card. I think that he does great dialogue. I'm probably the best that there is in that field. And he's also great at creating sympathetic characters. So he's one of my influences, obviously. Tolkien, I read because he had, I think once again, the archetypal literature. I just kept feeling that there was something immensely right with what he was doing, okay? But beyond that, you know, I have all sorts of people that I like for all different kinds of things. I like the style of Lucius Shepard. I think that he just has this luscious lyrical style that I'd love to emulate. When you look at Patrick Rothfuss, you know, he's a brand new writer, but he handles duality so well. You know, a person is never one thing or another. He's always something in the middle, and you know, which leaves a lot of room for, you know, what kind of person that character can become. You know, because he hasn't decided. So I like Patrick Rothfuss for one thing. When it comes to characterization, you know, I tend to like, I'm a little blocked on the name, Miles Borkosigan books.
Lois McMaster-Bujold.
Yes, Lois McMaster-Bujold, okay. She's, sorry, I always have a hard time with her name. It just doesn't sound human. Bujold, you know, McMaster is okay. But anyway. So I have different things that I like in different people. I love Connie Willis's sense of humor, for example. I like Ursula K. Le Guin and the way that she writes round stories that where the characters return to their beginning very often. Just a little different things, you know. I don't have any one person. I tend to come back and read Shakespeare every year, and I read certain poets on a regular basis. But other than that, those are my touchstones. Yeah.
Just going to ask, did you always know that you wanted to
be an author, or was it some other kind of...
No, you know, when I was a little kid, I remember realizing that I didn't really want to do anything for a living. And I was actually one day, I was walking down the street, and it was, you know, getting, it was probably really early, it was 7:30 in the morning or something, and I saw the Catholic priest down the street, and he was sitting on an apple tree reading the scriptures, and I thought, no, that's what I want to do for a living. I mean, this guy just sits around all day and gives a sermon once a week, 1 hour a week, you know. That sounded pretty good. So there was this short-term desire to be a priest. As I got older, you know, a little bit older, I thought maybe it would be fun to, I don't know. I actually became quite interested in medicine, and I was a pre-med major for a while. My parents wanted me to be an accountant, wanted me to be a CPA, so they sent me to school to, I ran their business for a few years, we had a meat company, grocery stores. So I had those kinds of things, but I also really wanted to be a doctor. You know, that was another love that I had. And also illustration, I liked art, so I had all sorts of different things that I wanted to do. It wasn't until I was about 17 or 18 that, actually I think I was 17, I had been reading Lord of the Rings, and as I was reading it, I started looking for other books like that. When I couldn't find other books like that, I started making up my own stories, and I was telling a friend one day, and he says, you know, you should take all this crap and put it in a book. And I thought, wow, what a great idea. I could actually maybe even make money doing that, you know. And so when I was 17, I kind of got the bug. But, you know, from the little town where I was from, you know, if you became a doctor, even that was unheard of. I mean, everybody grew up and went to work in the sawmill, you know, or either that or the brick factory. So that's kind of the path that you have laid out for you in life if you were born and raised in rural Oregon. And so I didn't really kind of know how to get there. I just felt really clueless. So I started reading books on how to write and that kind of thing. And came to it slowly. Yeah. Any other questions? Well, I do have a book coming out in the near future. I probably should announce. I've got in September. I have a book called In the Company of Angels. It's about the Willie Handcart Company. One of those books that I wrote by accident. I started doing some research. You know, my grandmother said, "Oh, I want you to write about this, you know, Willie Handcart thing." Not my grandmother. My wife's foster mother, actually. We call them grandma and grandpa. Anyway, she was running a mission up at Sixth Crossing and kept telling me how interesting this was. And I went up there and started listening and actually discovered it really was interesting. And so I started reading books on it. And after reading all of the biographies of the pioneers and all of the books on history and stuff and studying it for a year and a half, I decided I probably better write the book. So I wrote the book, and it's a big honking book, 175,000 words, about a woman named Eliza Gadd, who was the only non-Mormon to come across with the Mormon handcart companies. She was a nurse and a scientist and didn't believe in God or anything else like it. And she went through hell, and I was just fascinated by her story. So. I wrote In the Company of Angels, and that'll be coming out in September. And then I've got another book called Freaky Fly Day, which is a story, third book in the Ravenspell series, about a little boy who, of course, in the first book in the series, buys himself a mouse, discovers his mouse has magical powers when it turns him into a mouse, too, and forces him to go on a quest to free all the mice in the world from the pet shops. Anyway, in the third book, there's an evil fly that has been that takes over the world using his magical powers. And of course, my mice have to fight him. And since they're not quite strong enough, they have to rely on the sources of a fellow who's very much like Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, the world's greatest Republican politician. Who, of course, whenever there's a problem like this, he goes and solves it himself. Anyway, so I have Freaky Fly Day coming out also the 1st of September from Covenant Books. And then I've got my next book beyond that is my next Rune Lords book, book 8 in the Brew Lord series. It's called Berserker Lord. And it's got a new cover artist from the other books in the series, which makes it all look mean and violent, which is good because it's a particularly dark novel about one of my characters who discovers that he has some monstrous tendencies. Anyway, so that's what I've got coming out in this coming year, and thank you.